It was like when you're watching a movie with your parents and a really intense sex scene comes on. It was not my favorite way to spend time with Adrian, to be honest with you.
Now I find out. So I must admit, I didn't feel that way. And I think this difference might be kind of telling. I was worried going into it, but I was like, it's not a sexy movie. It's a horny movie, but mostly it's just a gooey movie. I was like, okay.
Spoken like a gay man, Adrian Daub.
it's just a lot of goo. I'm like the first 5 seconds, I'm like, oh, ooh. And then I was like, yeah, okay. Like, it's just very, it's sticky. There are a lot of sticky surfaces. It has a kind of juvenile fun with this stuff, but ultimately it's only skin deep. She thinks she's updating the material, right? It's not your mom and pop's, you know, Wuthering Heights. Like, the original Wuthering Heights is far more fucked up than this.
Oh, if you want to be a freak, like reveling in your own gross horniness and emphasizing the darkness of desire, bring back the necrophilia, you coward.
Exactly,
like, he
right?
digs up her corpse to, yes. quote unquote, embrace it.
Yes.
Like, Emily goes there.
Yeah, and Fennell does not. Fennell's goo is essentially ersatz goo. It's just posy goo. Hello, I'm Adrian Daw.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
Whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So, Adrian, today we are talking about the movie, the book, the phenomenon, the cultural experience that is Wuthering Heights.
That's right. Hot off the presses. If we don't boost this book from 1847, no one's going to read it.
So, Adrian, you and I took a trip down to a movie theater here in the San Francisco Mission to see the new adaptation of Wuthering Heights by Emerald Fennell? Fennell?
So I think it's Fennell, but yeah. You should just keep saying Fennell, and I'll keep saying Fennell. And one way or the other, someone's going to have egg on their face. That's a callback, guys. If you have seen the movie, eggs play an oddly prominent role.
Yeah. So Emerald Fennell is a filmmaker who makes these soap opera-y, like kind of trashy, but with a lot of pretensions, films that dramatize sexual politics, right? So she's a really interesting filmmaker for our purposes, not because she's an especially good one. I don't think she is. This reminded me of an insight you had, Adrian, about the horror genre back when we did our Powers of Horror film episodes for Halloween. It's like the horror director is operating often kind of based on instinct, and in so doing, with the sort of like unconscious or like slippages in their filmmaking, often sort of reveals something interesting that they maybe didn't intend to. I think Emerald Fennell works a little bit of a similar way. She sort of thinks she's doing one project and in the process reveals something different about contemporary gender relations and sexual politics than she perhaps expected to. And I'm really interested in discussing Wuthering Heights with you from that perspective.
Yeah, so a little bit more about Fennell. She's an actress. You might have seen her as Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown.
She was excellent as Camilla on The Crown, I have to say.
She's very, very good, yeah. She was in Call the Midwife. And otherwise, and this is kind of interesting, I think, for the purposes of this movie, she sort of cut her teeth as an actor, I would say, in period pieces. And then when she started directing, she moved away from that. At least the two movies that she's directed, they have a period piece feel to them in moments. They're not set necessarily in the here and now recognizably, but like people have cell phones, I guess is what it is. Those two movies would be Promising Young Woman from 2020, and Saltburn from 2023.
Promising Young Woman being sort of like a post-Me Too rape revenge fantasy with Carrie Mulligan, I believe, as
that
the
is right.
central character. And then Saltburn is sort of a riff on The Talented Mr. Ripley about sort of like class envy and sexual desire sort of mixing together in this country estate where a bunch of characters have gathered for a holiday.
Saltburn is basically, as I recall, The Talented Mr. Ripley reimagined, and I use that term very, very broadly, as a Ealing comedy about a screwy, rich, degenerate family and with more dongs.
And that's sort of similar to the way that Fennell treated her source material in this latest venture, Wuthering Heights, right? It is Wuthering Heights, the 1847 Emily Bronte novel that is about class and race and domestic violence and the commodification of women and like authenticity. And my pet theory is that Wuthering Heights is actually a book about real estate.
Yeah.
And Emerald Fennell reimagines it as a story about the transgressive power of sexual desire and the force of sexual desire, and makes it a very, very different story. And the sort of looseness of the approach to the source material is something that she like ultimately seems to embrace and then sort of disavow a little bit over the course of this adaptation. And so I think the relationship between Emerald Fennell's Wuthering Heights and Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, which are very different texts, is something that we're going to have to dig into and explore a little bit, because what she thinks she's doing with this book, or to this book, is something I'm really interested in discussing with you, Adrian.
Yeah, and so that does mean that we have to give a little bit of a synopsis of a book I'm guessing a lot of you will have read, so bear with us. I have never taught this book. I come to it entirely as a person who's read it, I think, 3 times in my life, and I've really loved it each time. There are people who are much more devoted to this book and who obviously will know a lot more than me. But I do think it's important to sort of keep in mind A, that what Fennell is doing is an interpretation of Wuthering Heights, and B, that any adaptation of Wuthering Heights kind of has to be an interpretation of Wuthering Heights, because that book resists filmic adaptation, I think, in a pretty interesting set of ways. Like, to adapt Wuthering Heights is to kind of give it a twist, because you have to. So Wuthering Heights was published by Emily Bronte in 1847, under the pseudonym Alice Bell, under which I think she published all her work.
Which was just some poems and then this novel. She died very young, at, I believe, 31 years old.
Yeah, she was born in 1818, died in 1848. And then her sister edited a second edition of the novel. So there's an 1847 version and there's an 1850 version of the novel. Emily Bronte is the sister to Anne Bronte, famous for Agnes Grey and the Tenant of Wildfell Hall, and Charlotte Bronte, famous for Jane Eyre, and also her brother Branwell Bronte, famous for Jack Squat.
So I might just like briefly gloss the Brontes, who are these famous three sisters who grew up really kind of in the middle of nowhere in this parsonage in Yorkshire, sort of northern rural England, which is a very beautiful and very like sparse and severe part of the UK.
Have you been to Highworth Parsonage?
I know. I want to really, really badly, but I've never made it.
It's beautiful. I bet it is.
It's the middle of nowhere. It's absolutely, it's remote, it's isolated, and it's not like whatever Treadwife fantasy of a rural life is like. It's a really severe landscape. It's rocky. It's difficult to farm there. And it's really, really very windy, right? So there's also not a lot of trees. It is a sparse, craggly, remote, and like empty landscape where these girls grew up, and they had a father who was pretty severe. Their mother died after having, like, you know, 7 children in 10 years, quite young. They had 2 older sisters who also died very young. They got sick at boarding school and died, and all of the family's hopes were put in their one brother, Branwell, who was supposed to take all their savings and go to London and enroll in art school and become this famous painter. And Branwell very famously took all that money, went to London, realized immediately that his ambitions were not matched by his talents, that he was not going to make it as an artist. He has this great sort of denial breakdown period where he gambles a lot of the family's money away and drinks it. And then he comes home in shame, completely having tarnished all the hopes of the family, and sets about, you know, dying very young, I believe at 31, of, I believe it was an infection, like tuberculosis, or is he the one who died burning in his bed because he was smoking in bed? That was also one of
them. I don't remember, but I think the oldest Bronte to die...
39, Charlotte.
Charlotte, right? Yeah.
Yeah, she makes it to 39. The rest all die younger. So, like, you have these girls who got no prospects whatsoever. I think probably the best biographical treatment of this aspect of their lives, like the Brontes as just sort of these, you know, economically bereft, like unmarriageable intellectual weirdos from nowhere is Elizabeth Hardwick's essay on the Brontes.
Yeah.
I think it's really excellent.
Oh, I know Elizabeth Hardwick's essay on the Brontes. Are you kidding me? That's why I reread it the most recent time, because I read the Hardwick essays.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's excellent. Everybody should read it. The New York Review put out a collection of her essays that they called Seduction and Betrayal, which is like particularly her essays that dwell on literature and gender and like literature and the status of women. Hardwick, not a feminist, I think you could really say, but somebody who thinks critically about the status of women and how it emerges in these like 19th century novels. And, you know, you have Charlotte and Anne, who are writing what I think are like much more conventional proto-Victorian novels about growing up, about the transformation of a heroine from a sort of like deprived creature that like takes solace in imagination into somebody who can exist in the real world and enters into that real world via marriage, right? Like this is classically the plot of her sister Charlotte's most famous novel, Jane Eyre, right? Emily is weirder. Emily is depicted in the biographical sketches we have of these women. And I think probably the best one comes from Charlotte Bronte's introduction to that 1850 reissue of Wuthering Heights. Emily has this kind of unfeminine severity to her. She is a darker creature. She was kind of more allied with Branwell. She took his death really hard. She has this sort of, Hardwick calls it a hardness that amounts ultimately to withdrawal, right? So like Charlotte and Anne are like daydreaming about, you know, getting rescued by a man and married, right? This is not to depict them as silly women who are not intellectually serious, because they were, but they had this sort of recourse to more conventional feminine desires. And Emily doesn't have that. It's impossible to think the way we think about, like with Emily Dickinson, of Emily Bronte, like having a boyfriend, you know, impossible to imagine Emily ever doing what Charlotte did, which was like going off to be a governess to this family in Belgium and like immediately becoming so like horny and psychologically obsessed with the father that she like has to get sent home, right? Like Emily is sort of outside of heterosexuality because she's outside of womanhood. She's too mean. She's too pragmatic. She's too comfortable with like human evil. And so what Charlotte says in her introduction to that 1850 edition of Wuthering Heights is that like, look, my sister made a portrait of herself in Heathcliff. And she's also like, I'm not really sure that that was a wise thing to create. She almost doesn't recommend the book. She's like, I don't think you can like say that it is advisable to invent a character like Heathcliff, one half of the central dyad of Wuthering Heights, but it is something that only my sister could have made. And she compares it to one of these like rocky outcroppings on the moors where they grew up. That's just sort of like weathered and giant and hard and unloving, you know, sort of like unforgiving. So why don't you take us briefly, Adrian, through the insane plot of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, and then maybe we can get into the quite different plot of Emerald Fennell's Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, and maybe I'll talk briefly about different ways in which different adaptations have wrangled with the plot, because I think that sort of throws a spotlight on the choices that Fennell makes here. So, Wuthering Heights. And my apologies to all my colleagues in English departments who are now having to listen to this. I'm doing the best I can.
If you haven't read Wuthering Heights, by the way, if you haven't had the pleasure of actually reading Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, like, don't listen to us. Go read that book, because it's fucking amazing. It's a pleasure, and it's propulsive, and it's weird, and you won't be able to put it down.
Yeah, so although it is a novel of the early Victorian era, it's not set in the Victorian era. I believe the opening takes place in 1801 with our first narrator, Mr. Lockwood, becoming a tenant at Thrushcross Grange, which is somewhere in the Yorkshire Moors. And his landlord is Heathcliff, who is just off-putting as shit. The entire place is just weird in ways that sort of feel borrowed from Gothic fiction. Like, all the servants are maniacal. Everyone's emoting all over the place. It's a messy place in ways that feel very Gothic. And basically, he's trying to figure out what the hell is happening over there. What kind of ship are they running? Long story short, his servant, Nellie Dean turns out to have a connection to that story.
Lockwood goes to meet his landlord and then has a real weird time. And then goes back across the moor to the house that he's rented. And it's like, God, it's fucked up over there. And Nellie is like, oh, I know these people. I used to work for them. Let me give you all of the gossip.
Yeah, most of the novel is basically her gossip. It takes place about 30 years, I think, sometime in the 1770s. There's a family. It used to be wealthier than it is now. It has fallen on hard times. It's living on this estate called Wuthering Heights. And it's a daughter and a son. And one day, the head of the household brings in this boy that he's picked up in Liverpool, or where is he?
In Liverpool, which is a port town. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this boy who is described throughout the novel as, and this is something we're going to have to come back to when we talk about Fennell's version of this story, as somehow less than white. There's a great book I read a couple of years ago about Shakespeare's White Others. It's not clear whether he's not white or he's just not white in the way that like a mid-18th century Briton would recognize, but there's something a little different about him.
The concept of whiteness as we understand it is not exactly applicable to the early 19th century, right? This is something that like is getting mediated through different historical conditions. So white is a capacious category to us and would have been perhaps a little less so to them. But they refer to him as like kind of Asian, right? They're like, you're a gypsy is a lot of what they say.
Yeah.
So like indicating that he is some sort of, you know, maybe Roma extraction. There's one conversation that Nellie has with him at one point that she recounts to Lockwood where she was like, I mean, you're obviously Chinese or Indian or something, which is not precise enough to give you a lot of confidence in what this like Yorkshire maid understands about the Orient. But there's also, you know, like people have made scholarly cases that he was actually just like Irish. There's a lot of debate over this question. But one of the big questions that everybody who has to make an adaptation of Wuthering Heights has to answer is, how are you going to cast Heathcliff? Right?
Yeah.
Because he has to be an avatar of this sort of hard, kind of wild, violent force in the characters' lives. And that is, in the Emily Bronte version, sort of mediated through his race.
Yeah.
This way where he's not just non-white, he is, by being non-white, also sort of like a symbol of wildness in this way that we would, I think, like fairly describe as a little racist, right?
Yeah.
But then like whitewashing that figure has its own exclusionary implications. It's a difficult one.
Yeah. And so Mr. Earnshaw brings this kid back. Initially, Catherine Earnshaw is horrified by this creature that he brings in. And her brother Hindley is immediately antagonistic towards him. Well, Earnshaw sort of, as he grows older, becomes more and more distant from his own children and starts making Heathcliff, the boy he picked up, sort of his favorite, which has disastrous consequences because basically Kathy really sort of starts liking him and they sort of form this very codependent dyad, I guess, while Hindley is angry at this interloper and once his father fades away and dies, becomes absolutely sadistic in treating Heathcliff. Really, really difficult descriptions of that.
Heathcliff like has a status in this family where he's an outsider but treated as an equal. And then after the father dies, he's very much not treated as an equal. They make him sleep in the barn. He's relegated to the status of a servant. And as you alluded to, Adrian, Heathcliff is subjected to a lot of violence by Kathy's older brother. And Kathy, meanwhile, is growing into adulthood as the daughter of a poor but noble family. And she winds up staying for an extended period of time at the home of the neighbors across the moor.
So the Lintons move into Thrushcross Grange, which is hard to say but easy to read. Right across the way, basically, the place that our narrator, Mr. Lockwood, is living at. And they're sort of conventional and nice in all the ways that the Earnshaw clan with every passing year seems to be less and less capable of, right? It's almost a sitcom setup of like the Addams family and then next door, the all-American family. The Lintons just seem like totally decent people who have no idea about the freight train of gothic fucked upness that is about to collide with them.
Yeah, they're these like well-adjusted, unsuspecting normies.
Yeah, yeah.
And they get this fucked up family sort of inflicted on them.
Yeah. Kathy, for a variety of reasons, is interested in and eventually accepts a proposal from Edgar Linton. And Heathcliff is outraged by this and leaves, only to return years later, mysteriously rich and with revenge in his heart, and takes Isabella Linton, Edgar's little sister, as the way to exact his revenge.
Right. And that relationship between Isabella Linton and Heathcliff is brutal in a way that doesn't just match, but really eclipses what Heathcliff went through as a child, right? He kidnaps her in this like very like dubiously consensual marriage. He kills her dog. He like takes her little Pomeranian and hangs it from a fence post as he's like sort of spiriting her away from her brother's house. And then Emily Bronte is quite explicit. He beats and rapes her constantly. And she is in this state of absolute distress and sort of falls apart and eventually gives birth to his child and also runs away.
As he's sort of revenging himself upon Kathy by essentially abusing and raping this absolute bystander, Kathy falls ill and dies. It's about it feels like halfway. Like you're definitely nowhere near the end when she dies.
The novel is shaped like the letter A. You ascend in action up until the death of Kathy. Everything is leading up until Kathy's death. And then the second half of the novel, everything is consequence of Kathy's death, right? So the relationship between Heathcliff and Kathy is really only the first half of the book. And they're never exactly a couple. Although, yeah, like, Emily Bronte does imply pretty strongly that they're doing it. But they never, like, really manage to be together in a fulsome way because Kathy is drawn by the allure of maturity and functionality and class away from what Heathcliff understands as the more authentic sort of, like, force of
their attraction.
Yeah, but also, like, not just their attraction. Like, their attraction is a byproduct of their like allergy to convention, right? Mm-hmm. Their connection with each other is about rejecting the civilized world and sort of like the outside world. And so she transcends into, you know, civilized public life and abandons him. And he sort of like takes his vengeance on her. And she gives birth to Edgar Linton's child, a daughter, who is called very confusingly also Kathy, little Kathy, and then promptly dies from complications of childbirth.
Yeah. Well, you said their relationship doesn't last, but of course the rest of the book is taken up with their posthumous relationship, right? Basically, her haunting of him.
Well, you forget that he fucking digs up her corpse.
And her actual corpse. And Mr. Lockwood sees in his first stay at Wuthering Heights, Heathcliff is rushing out onto the moor screaming for something only he can see. Then it turns out that Heathcliff is feeling quite literally haunted by his dead soulmate. And as the sort of second generation takes over the narrative, basically Heathcliff becomes this kind of terror that completely dominates everything, but through him, sort of, Kathy does too. The original Kathy Earnshaw does too.
Yeah, so Heathcliff, who had been excluded from the family in his youth, now becomes the sort of like patriarchal terrorist, right? He rules over this family through sort of malice and violence, and really like quite brutal violence. And he brings the family home under his own possession. He buys it. And then he manages to finagle through really like conniving, profound cynicism, also ownership of Thrushcross Grange, right? So now he doesn't just own the house of the Earnshaw family that initially sort of like took him in but didn't treat him as an equal. Now he also owns this like symbolic other higher familial and class plane to which Kathy ascended by rejecting him, right? So now he's the owner of all of it, and he's treating everybody under his purview with absolute like fascistic cruelty.
Yeah.
Then it's about the second generation like sort of fighting to get out from under him,
yeah,
as he descends into madness. And Kathy is very much present as a ghost, right?
Yeah.
She is on the moors calling for him. She is pounding at the window asking to be let in Kate Bush's famous song. That is dramatizing that scene where Kathy is like banging on the window of Wuthering Heights, asking Heathcliff to let her back in, but he cannot do so because she is dead. And this sort of like irreconcilable loss is visited not just on the central couple, but like becomes the defining tragedy of all these other people's lives, even though they're just like merely collateral damage to these like damaged people who have been very cruel to each other.
And so the second half of the novel really is just a constellation of tensions, basically, of people sort of grinding each other down. And like, it's just, yeah, hell is other people or hell is family, basically. But then we do have sort of this coda where we get back to Mr. Lockwood. Mr. Lockwood goes away for a while and then comes back and then gets updated on everything having resolved, which has the effect that Nellie's narration really never gets resolved. So at the center of Wuthering Heights, there really is this kind of long stretch where people are being awful to each other, mostly Heathcliff, but not just Heathcliff, but nothing much happens, right? Nothing much changes. And that is why in adapting this book, the question is like, what do you do with that second half? The first half has the problem that you are kind of telling a love story of which no narrator ever tells us. There's several narrators in this book. No one ever says like, oh, they totally did it. As you say, it's heavily implied, but that's about it. And then the second half, it's just people making each other miserable in these like sometimes quotidian, sometimes like outré kind of grand guignol ways, but that where again, like not much happens. And as people have been adapting this book, and they have been for a while, that second generation, I think, becomes the real problem in terms of adaptation. I looked through a bunch of adaptations because I was interested in how they resolve this, because I wasn't satisfied with Fennell, who, spoiler alert, cuts off at Kathy's death. It ends on Kathy's deathbed. And we'll talk about why we think that that's probably a bad idea. But I was like, well, how have others done this? So there appears to be a 1920 version of Wuthering Heights, but I wasn't able to find that. There's a very famous and Oscar-winning 1939 American adaptation starring Merle Oberon and Laurence Olivier, directed by William Wyler. I watched it. It's on YouTube. It keeps most of the frame narrative, though it's Lockwood is just a traveler who happens by Wuthering Heights and like, what the fuck is going on? Which I think actually kind of works. It's like, he doesn't have to live next door. He can just be like, y'all, the vibes here are really weird. Can you enlighten me? It has some very gorgeous shots of the Yorkshire Dales as played by Topanga Canyon. It's altogether too sunny.
Yeah.
You thank the Lord for location shooting after seeing that movie. You're like, that is California sunlight, and I hate to break it to you. Everybody should not be so dour, because it's just the swaying palm trees should really... No, they're not swaying palm trees, but it is very recognizably Southern California. There's like five or six BBC adaptations starting in the 50s. There have been TV adaptations into the 2020s. There's a version with Richard Burton as Heathcliff.
Oh, weird. Okay.
There's a 1970 version with Timothy Dalton, a later James Bond, and with Julian Glover as Hindley Earnshaw, who has a very different role in this version, much more positive. Then there's a version with Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche.
That one's pretty fun. But that adds a framing story where, and this is kind of like my favorite, they actually have a character on screen representing Emily Bronte. And yeah, guess who it is?
It's Sinead O'Connor. I've seen this one.
It's Sinead O'Connor. Like, I think that's just perfect casting. It's like, who is the most intense woman we can possibly find?
Yeah.
And like, make her represent Emily Bronte is perfect.
And that movie also is rare among these, that it really leans into the second half and has,
yeah,
the, I think, pretty elegant solution of just having its famous leading lady, Juliette Binoche, play both Kathys. They're Kathys, so like, why not? kind of works. And it's really interesting in that it doesn't avoid the framing narrative, but actually adds another, which I always like when movies go for this. It's like, yeah, look, this is complex. Why not make it more so? So that's a really famous one. It wasn't very successful at the time, and I don't think the reviews were all that kind. What I wanted to draw people's attention to is Richard Burton, Sir Laurence Olivier, Timothy Dalton, Ralph Fiennes are some of the finest and also whitest actors you can find.
Yeah.
And they're kind of heartthrobs, right? These are people who would play like romantic leads. Dalton is 10 years away from being James Bond. Burton, you know, is in Cleopatra. These are cast as romantic leads in a role that frankly doesn't really warrant that, right? This is the other structural problem with this book, that if you've cast a famous dude in this role, you're kind of going to romanticize what Emily Bronte doesn't really romanticize, right?
Well, most adaptations of this book treat it as a love story. And, you know, the most successful ones don't shy away from Heathcliff as the abuser. I think that's pretty potent in the Juliette Binoche and Ralph Fiennes adaptation. Kathy and Heathcliff, but particularly Heathcliff, are really, really bad people. They're cruel, they're sarcastic, they're violent, they're manipulative, they're inflicting a lot of pain on the people around them. And so the effort to cast their relationship with each other as like sort of aspirational or sort of endearing or like hot is something that you find happening, I think, partly with the casting choices, right?
Yeah.
One thing that happens a lot is that Heathcliff is cast not just as a white guy, but kind of like a pretty white guy.
Yeah.
You know, like a guy with a kind of, I think we should talk about this when we get to the Fennell version and her choice to cast Jacob Elordi. It's like they're cast as these sort of like feline guys. They're like desirable, but they're not like physically imposing, right? They're not guys whose bodies indicate a capacity for violence, right? It's like, it's actually kind of hard. It was hard for me watching Jacob Elordi to like believe him as the author of violence. I was like, it's like most of these chicks could snap you in half like a twig, you know? The body of Heathcliff has to be cast in a very different way that sort of minimizes his violence for these screen adaptations. And I think that there's sort of a reflex to making a Wuthering Heights movie fit into a romance genre convention that the source material doesn't really fit with. And there's also some like dangerous political impulses there to sort of make abuse seem either not very serious or like kind of sexy.
So there is that. There's also the broader formal problem, which is that we harp on the fact that we don't know whether Kathy and Heathcliff do it. But that hides a bigger problem, which is that we only ever get other people's say-so about their relationship. It's entirely seen from the outside. And there is a way to represent that, but you don't cast Richard Burton, Ralph Fiennes, or Timothy Dalton and go for that. Like, then you're going to get a lot of very good actors playing off each other, spelling out what this relationship's about. There is something deeply unknowable about the central dyad in this book. What's more, their love for each other is cast as something that's probably not a good thing. It creates unbelievable collateral damage all the time.
It ruins lives, including their own. Yeah.
Yeah. It's described, you know, the way a murder might be described, right? Like, it's like Rashomon, right? In exiting the movie theater, we thought of Gatsby and Daisy Buchanan, right? And The Great Gatsby, where also, like, movie adaptations tend to think, like, oh, this is a story about star-crossed lovers. Like, no, these are terrible people, and they're terrible for each other. And what they see in each other, like, Nick Carraway is like, I don't know. Like, honestly, they're both pretty vapid, right? there's something like that here. It's not that we know there's nothing, but thanks to Nelly, we don't know what there is, right? Mm-hmm. Nelly just doesn't know. And that's something that is really difficult to maintain once you apply the kind of romance paradigm to it. And you don't cast Timothy Dalton, a smoldering man at the worst of times. There were some worst of times. And then expect, we're like, oh, we'll keep it at arm's length and we just don't know what they're up to each other and what they are to each other.
You also don't cast Margot Robbie, a woman so stereotypically hot that she literally played Barbie, you know?
Yeah.
The casting choices go both ways, right? Yeah, though like Heathcliff is almost an avatar of evil and Kathy is sort of more ambivalent, but they're both bad people who wreak havoc. This is a story about like villains, not victims, right? People who are actively and repeatedly choosing to harm others.
Yeah, it's just a poor fit for the screen, which doesn't mean that you can't make a movie out of it, but it does mean that there are these challenges, right?
Right.
The fact that it's about the central couple that is not ever really a couple, where one member dies halfway through, that it's very perspectival and we really don't know whom to trust, right? There's a chance that like they are fine people. It's just that Nellie fucking hates them. Possible, unlikely, but possible, right?
Well, Emerald Fennell thinks so.
Yes. And then also it's a book about, it's funny, it's a book about books. The wildness of Heathcliff and Kathy. They're these feral children running around Wuthering Heights together. And it's clearly modeled on the Bronte sisters' upbringing in the parsonage. At the same time, they didn't run around like this. What Bronte is doing is transposing their literary effort, which were very early and very prodigious, and sort of mapping them onto human behavior.
Ooh, say more. What do you mean by that?
Well, the Bronte sisters didn't do, for all we know, what Heathcliff and Kathy get up to. What they did was write about it, right? They wrote stories. They told each other stories. And the wildness of the Bronte sisters is, to some extent, a literary displacement. I think that's what Elizabeth Hardwick describes as that, right?
Yeah, she describes it as a virgin story, right? Like what the Brontes did was they created, famously together, the three sisters, a vast imaginary world as children that they wrote down. So they had an intensity sort of displaced onto their imaginations that these characters are finding in one another.
Exactly. And I think that makes it really, really hard to make a movie out of it too. The fact that like this is ultimately about literary form. Right? This is ultimately about what it means to tell a story. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to tell that story if you then don't signpost for the viewer that you're getting someone's version of events. And guess what Emerald Fennell does? She removes any indication that any of this might be focalized through unreliable narrators. And she's just like, nope, it's what happened. They did it in a carriage. Then they did it on the moors.
I would say that Emerald Fennell makes the whole thing kind of dreamlike, right? It's a little druggy.
Yeah.
The sense that perhaps we cannot trust our own understanding of this relationship or what we are receiving of it might be more filtered through like some of her stylistic choices. But the fact that I have to like venture that as a possible guess and like the most generous possible reading of Emerald Fennell's aesthetic and design choices, which I think are really weird in this adaptation, might not be like a great endorsement of the movie.
Yeah. Well, let's maybe talk about the aesthetic of the movie a little bit. Because the movie, as you say, and I hadn't thought of it this way before, but yes, it replaces the multi-perspectival aspects of the narrative with tonal and or stylistic clashes. The movie seems to have three visual modes, I would say. One is kind of discount Tim Burton, which is Wuthering Heights, with like real sort of Hammer horror energy. It is always foggy with some sort of German expressionist design thrown in.
Yeah, it's like very black. There's like these large, stark silhouettes of a background. It's a little like crooked and, you know, black and white checkered floors. It reminds me a lot of like a cheap play in a black box theater, you know, like the community college theater department is putting on, you know, like a music video made by somebody who works at Hot Topic.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like cheese, and it's cheesy on purpose, I think, to give like maximum credit to her.
It's also excessive, right? Like when the father in this version is a drinker, so you have to have two corners devoted to just empty bottles.
Right. It's cartoony. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that something that Hardwick points out, and we should probably just link to the Hardwick in our show notes if we can, if it's not like a terrible copyright violation to do that. But like one thing Hardwick says, she talks about these two Byronic principles of Kathy and Heathcliff, who are these sort of like little crucibles of like passion and intensity together. And she says that they are uplifted by their prosaic surroundings, right? They've got this sort of like no-nonsense working class Nelly. They've got the sort of banal alcoholism of Harriton. They've got the like nice bourgeois Linton family. And that the contrast with these like aggressively normal people makes their intensity and their like recourse to evil stand out even more. And that's not what Fennell does. Fennell puts these crazy people with these like carnivalesque flights of passion into a carnivalesque world.
Yeah. The second world is that of Thrushcross Grange, which I can only describe as Bridgerton.
Yes.
Basically, Kathy ambles out of a Hammer horror film and is like, oh, I'm in Bridgerton now. And it really feels like, yeah, it feels like, you know, Dorothy arriving in Oz.
She comes into like a literal walled garden. I think there's like actually a croquet game or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And when she enters that walled garden of the Lintons, beautiful, functional, high class, like much more brightly lit world, Isabella is literally talking about Romeo and Juliet, right? Yeah. Like this like implicit comparison of these two characters to this kind of like paradigmatic love story. It was, I thought, like really heavy-handed and dark.
Yeah. And then the third mode is just, there are scenes, especially in the Dales, clearly shot on location, that just seem to say, hey, these are the beautiful locations that we're thinking Bronte was thinking of when she wrote this book. And there's kind of no stylization whatsoever. And you're like, okay, what does that mean? Like, is this now the natural? Is that the real? What's going on here? Like, there's very few stylistic tricks once we get sort of into nature. They're both the children at the beginning and the adults later on sort of seem to just be inhabiting, I don't know, a Merchant Ivory film from 1991. It's just like, it's deliberately non-stylized, right, in its presentation.
The moments where she chooses to break with historical accuracy and convention, which are pretty consistent, but sometimes she draws more attention to it than at others. I will say, like, one interesting thing is she did, like, this, like, almost Almodovar homage where she gives each character a color.
Yeah.
So, like, Kathy is red and pink. Heathcliff is black. Edgar Linton is green. And Isabella Linton is yellow. And these like kind of recurring colors sort of like laces you through the different stylistic modes. But I found it like a little incoherent. I asked one of my friends who is a like big, you know, Bronte head. I was like, Jessica, I know that the bedroom that Edgar Linton makes for Kathy at Thrushcross Grange that he says is painted the color of her face, like, does that have any purpose beyond, like, setting up this shot where Jacob Elordi licks the wall? And she's like, no, I don't think so. I mean, like, you know, but then, like, then you're also like, okay, it's like, it's a literal prison of her body because we're living in a world where women's bodies are commodities, right? So the other thing that's very different about this Fennell version of Wuthering Heights is that Kathy sort of like dutifully goes and marries Edgar Linton,
yeah,
right? She's like, oh, my dad is this like dissolute alcoholic. The Wuthering Heights is falling into disrepair. To save the family, I need to take this sacrifice and marry this rich, boring guy. It's not really what happens in the book. In the book, she's kind of like genuinely drawn to the glamour and the pretty dresses and the sort of like promise of a conventional upper class life, right?
Yeah, although I guess I wonder whether Fennell would say it comes out to the same thing, which is, Kathy leaves because she grows up. As you say, like, this is a book about real estate, but it's also a book maybe like the great American fiction of the 21st century, Arrested Development. It is about how real estate is really just a stand-in for Arrested Development. She has Heathcliff acknowledge, and I don't remember whether that's a book line, that he bought Wuthering Heights because he could picture them there. And that, I feel like, comes through in the novel as well, that he is sort of drawn back ever again into the world of childhood, and she, for whatever reason, sees Thrushcross Grange as the next step, as like, well, we can't do this forever, Heathcliff. We got to get out there in the world. I got to live on a second estate at some point. Like, this is like, I can't live and die here.
Well, something interesting about the ending, and spoiler alert for those of you who have not read this book published in 1847, is that in the Wuthering Heights book, Kathy successfully gives birth to a healthy child, right? She dies as a result of childbirth. Like, she dies sort of because she cannot enter into this next generational future, right?
Yeah.
In the Fennell adaptation, she dies because she has an incomplete miscarriage and she develops sepsis. And like the sort of birth of this removal out of the childish fantasy world that she shared with Heathcliff, or the birth of a more authentic relationship with Heathcliff, both of those fail, right? And she cannot give birth. She cannot enter into the future. And therefore, this like fetus dies inside of her and kills her.
Yeah, I mean, they're both figured in the Fennell adaptation as themselves infants that have not matured, right?
As she's dying, she sees the actor who plays Child Heathcliff like emerge outside of her garden and call to her.
Well, and she says of him, I named him, he is mine. There's like a lot of play with the idea of pets, et cetera, et cetera. Like, yes, that's about possessiveness. Yes, that's about the violence of childish greed, but it is also just an index of someone who hasn't quite matured, right? Like, Robbie plays Kathy as being petulant in a way that doesn't feel quite adult, right?
Yeah.
There's something here about their dyad that basically has enabled each other's failure to grow up, right? It's essentially a Kevin Smith movie or something like that. They're mall rats. They're West Yorkshire mall rats, yeah.
Yeah, there's a petulance. They're very, very selfish people in a way that seems childlike. I'm not sure that that's so different from the book.
Yeah, yeah. Hardwick in her essay says, Catherine in Wuthering Heights is nihilistic, self-indulgent, bored, restless, nostalgic for childhood, unmanageable. And I think, I wonder whether Fennell read that essay and wanted to capture that, because I think that is exactly, that's the thesis statement of how both of these people function in this adaptation.
I think something that really comes across, partly because we are getting Nellie's narration to Lockwood in the Bronte version, is this like exasperated sense of just like anger at Kathy's entitlement.
Yeah.
Almost as much as the anger at Heathcliff's violence. But do you want to talk about what Fennell does with Nellie? Because I think this is really interesting and that might bring us back to race.
Yeah.
Because it's an adaptation that deals with race in some weird ways.
Yeah. So Nellie, who is a unreliable narrator, even in the book, here becomes an agent and becomes kind of included in their little fucked up game with each other. As Moira was saying, the Kathy in the movie dies from an incomplete miscarriage. And as she does, Heathcliff sends her one letter after the other, and Nellie is shown burning them all. And the entire time, Nellie's like, you got to get out of bed. Stop being such a wuss. Come on, come on, come on. And then eventually she realized that she's in septic shock and she's going to die. And then Catherine whispers to her something like, I'm sure you meant well, or something like that. And Nellie says something like, you know, I don't think I did. So she's actually, there's a third party. There's a triad now. And everyone's kind of a sadistic freak, you know?
Right. And crucially, like the death and the failed reconciliation is mirrored with the one in Romeo and Juliet, right?
Yeah.
It's not that these people made choices that hurt each other out of like narcissism or pridefulness or like selfishness or cowardice, right? It's that there was just a miscommunication. And like, but for this agent, you know, like either like the stalled male in Romeo and Juliet or like the destroyed male by an evil, like jealous, sort of nefarious figure in the Fennell Wuthering Heights, like, but for this interference with the attempt to communicate the truth, the past would be restored and we'd all be okay. Like, that's where I think like Fennell kind of pulls her punches. She makes this a much less dark version of the story in several ways. And, you know, one of them is in making the central couple sort of like less responsible for their own unhappiness.
Yeah. And there's a crucial conversation in both the book and the movie that Heathcliff overhears and misunderstands. And in this version, Nellie brings about or facilitates that misunderstanding, knowing that he's listening.
No, she knows he listens in the book, but she's like, Kathy, you probably shouldn't talk like that. Like, her account is that she's kind of more passive.
Yeah.
But then she like pretty quickly is like, oh, he ran away because he heard you say that shit about him. Yeah.
Yeah. This Nellie is much more of an active participant. She is an active manipulator in some ways. We're given to understand right away that it's not the Nellie of the novel, because the Nellie of the novel is a salt of the earth, as you say, sort of proletarian North Yorkshire type.
Whereas the Nellie of the Fennell adaptation is a sort of illegitimate daughter of a nobleman who has this like claim on elite status that she's been denied, like a little parallel Heathcliff. And she's also crucially played by a woman of color, right? So this is an adaptation that casts Heathcliff, the ambiguously raced character of the book, as Jacob Elordi, I think possibly one of the whitest people on earth, but makes the villain, the sort of like inserted villain of Nelly into a woman of color, and makes the sort of like obstacle husband of Edgar Linton. He is also played by a South Asian actor. So it's an East Asian Nelly and a South Asian Edgar.
Yeah, Nelly Dean is played by Hong Chau as an adult and by an actress I wasn't familiar with as a child or as a young woman. And it's very interesting that she brings race in sort of on the margins. The movie neither blazes entirely through the racial question, nor does it really tangle with it. It seems to want to sort of acknowledge that it's aware of it, and then that's good enough, right?
But we have to talk about the racial allusion, which is that one of the scenes that Fennell uses to sort of illustrate Jacob Elordi Heathcliff's abuse in childhood is that she has him be whipped by the drunken father, right? And as an adult, Heathcliff has whip marks on his back. He's got these sort of like lash, like scarred over lash markings. And this evokes, of course, the famous photograph.
The poor Peter, or the whipped Peter.
Yeah, a famous photograph of a, you know, survivor of enslavement whose back is covered in some really horrific scarring from a enslaver's whip, right? This is a black man's scars in the Fennell version transposed onto a white man's body.
Yeah, so there is, so to me, I have to be honest that that for me was the worst of both worlds. I'm like, so you're aware of it, and then you don't really do anything with it, which is sort of like how the movie treats a lot of its gender issues too, where you're like, okay, you're aware that this is an issue, and then you just kind of put a check mark behind it and move on. And it's like, well, no, like interpreting this novel would mean grappling with them and interpreting these things. And you just can't be like, and that is also a thing that people have remarked on in this book.
Yeah. I mean, I think this might bring us to a kind of final note, which is the weird sex politics of this movie.
Yes.
This is a really horny movie. It is a movie with like a lot of allusions to vaginas and like what vaginas look and sound like when they are aroused, right? So there's like a lot of noise, a lot of like slappy, gooey, like macaroni in a pot in the Cardi B valence noise. Like that noise is repeated. There's a lot of eggs, like sticking your fingers into raw eggs. There's a long scene with dough, like a big ball of wet dough being sort of like slapped around. There's one scene where Robbie Roby sticks her finger into this like aspic gelatin mold. It's sort of like reveling in the evocation of what bodies sound like during sex. It also opens, like I think at this point pretty famously, with like sounds that sound like sexual exertion, like somebody grunting or like groaning a little bit. And then you see that it's actually somebody hanging. It's a hanging scene. There's a similar scene where like some servants at Wuthering Heights are like butchering a pig, and there's some like grunting noises as somebody like sticks a knife, you know, like runs a knife down the like corpse or the like carcass of this animal. And then like one of the other servants goes harder. You know, there's like a lot of evocation of sex and like a hinting at the proximity of sex and death, right? Like it's gross, it's violent. It's got this like darkness at the center of it. That's part of Fennell's thesis about sexuality.
Yeah. I fully agree.
Can I just like revel for our listeners and underline for our listeners how wildly uncomfortable this was to watch sitting next to Adrian?
I am.
It was like when you're like watching a movie with your parents and a really intense sex scene comes on. It was not my favorite way to spend time with Adrian, to be honest with you.
Now I find out. So I must admit I didn't feel that way. And I think this difference might be kind of telling. I was worried going into it, but I was like, it's not a sexy movie, and it's not a horny movie, but mostly it's just a gooey movie. I was like, okay,
spoken like a gay man, Adrian Daub.
it's just a lot of goo. I'm like, I like the first 5 seconds, I'm like, oh, ooh. And then I was like, yeah, okay, like it's just very, it's sticky. There are a lot of sticky surfaces, but I think to me that was kind of telling. It has a kind of juvenile fun with this stuff, but ultimately, it's only skin deep. And then I think part of it is also that, like, she thinks she's updating the material, right? It's not your mom and pop's, you know, Wuthering Heights. Like, the original Wuthering Heights is far more fucked up than this.
Oh, if you want to be a freak, like, reveling in your own gross horniness and emphasizing the darkness of desire, like, bring back the necrophilia, you coward.
Exactly,
like, he digs up her corpse to, quote unquote, embrace it.
Yes.
Like, Emily goes there.
Yeah, and Fennel does not. Fennel's goo is essentially ersatz goo. It's just posy goo. And I think part of that is that she's kind of reacting to 170 years of reception to this book. And she thinks, like, oh, I'm not going to make a period drama. So, like, yes, if you were to imagine a Merchant Ivory adaptation of this book, like, yes, it would be a lot less squicky and macaroni-esque than this.
It would be more, like, dignified and sensual kind of a bodice ripper than the, like, gross and horny kind of a bodice ripper that Emerald Fennell has made. I think, like, the 1992 one with Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche is like this. You know, like, the sex scenes are implied when people sort of, like, gaze longingly over the moor.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, it's, and whereas in Emerald Fennell, the sex scenes are implied, like, through sex scenes. It's not implication. There's no subtext. It's just text. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I do think that there is this. This is a headline that I know you love from The Onion of, you know, so Emerald Fennell is just going door to door trying to shock people with fish and aspic. It's like, again, like, the book is way more shocking. I don't know why we're doing this.
Well, I don't think she's just responding to adaptations of Wuthering Heights and receptions of Wuthering Heights. I think she's also responding to the, like, blockbuster movie landscape, which has been, over the past decade, like, very sexless, like, very, like, you know, the classic critique of Superman movies, like, everybody has these perfect, like, almost inhuman bodies that it is impossible to imagine fucking, right? It's like a really, like, sexless cinema. And so she's kind of, like, going, I think, trying to be very aggressive about the sexuality of the story as a corrective in an attempt, as Richard Brody at The New Yorker, who's kind of like this offbeat movie critic who always loves the movies that everybody hates and hates the movies that all the other critics love. And he loved Wuthering Heights. And he says it, like, has nothing to do with the book. It's not a good adaptation or a successful adaptation of the book, but it is a revival of the romance genre. And, like, that's what she's trying to do. And when I was trying to think about what I wanted to say about this movie to our listeners, I honestly, like, thought a lot about our conversation with Abby Kluchin of Ordinary Unhappiness when she came on the podcast to talk about romanticy, right?
Yeah.
And clearly Emerald Fennell is taking from some of that genre and taking from some of the conventions that it's reviving. Things like the fated mate is big in this movie. Things about, like, enemies to lovers, like the kind of, like, hostility between Kathy and Heathcliff and their sort of ill treatment of each other as being a, like, vehicle for their desire that, like, kind of magnifies its intensity. Like, that's all in there. I think this is, like, a movie that has an intent to arouse.
Yeah.
But it's also a little bit like once again, it's like somebody who works at Hot Topic, like, doing the Hot Topic version of what S&M is, right? It's a little juvenile and it doesn't quite go there.
The other thing I took away from our conversation with Abby was exactly that, that this is also kind of a resurgence of the trauma plots. And I to me, that was one of the things that made this movie less than successful, in the sense that, like, and I want to be careful about this, that as a narrative technique, trauma has this, as opposed to something that, that happens in people's lives, it has this difficulty that it flattens explanatory modes, right? And I think that's kind of what happened here. Part of what happens with Catherine and Heathcliff is unknowable. And part of what makes them so terrifying is, you're like, how did you get this way? Well, Emerald Fennell has an answer for that. And it's like, it's violence, right? It's just all the violence you put into this. And she seems super interested in the etiology of how these people get to be this way, but the etiology is ultimately, like, super one note, right? Which I feel is something that we don't get in the book because, A, we can't know because they never tell us, but B, because there's a sense that the book is really kind of trying to make an anti-Rousseauist point, or someone in the book, someone narrating in the book is trying to make an anti-Rousseauist point and just be like, look, maybe it was society, maybe it was capitalism, maybe it was, some people just are kind of fucked up and they shouldn't be friends with each other. Like, not all kids are good. They're bad kids. Like, what do you want? Right? And like, I'm not saying that that's ultimately the truth of Wuthering Heights, but what makes Wuthering Heights to me such a bracing read is that you are entertaining that possibility. And in Fennell, the first five scenes are just basically like, watch a guy get hanged. Watch someone get beaten. Watch a pig get butchered. And then you could almost imagine, like, someone, like, swiveling around in their chair and be like, And how could you expect these children to grow up to be anything else, right? And you're like, no, come on.
But all of that is also supposed to be sexy. It's like, look at this guy get hanged, and then look at this couple that's so aroused by it that they start making out. So, like, I think this is a point well taken about the character of Heathcliff that Fennell creates, right? You're making basically the point that Perul Segal made in her 2021 piece for The New Yorker, I think it was 2021, against the trauma plot, right? And she's talking about trauma as a narrative device. She's really going after A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. And Segal says, like, look, this book doesn't do the work of building a really complex, interesting character because it uses a shortcut of this main character's past experiences of violence, right, as formative and explanatory. What Perul Segal, I think, would deny doing in that piece, but which I think she was functionally doing, is also critiquing the use of trauma as it had emerged in Me Too, right? She's like, these Me Too stories place trauma at the center of these women's lives in a way that is not sustainable or responsible or like adult, right? This is the critique of Perul Segal that Jamie Hood makes in her excellent book, Trauma Plot, right? And it's interesting to me that the concept of the trauma plot as this sort of like narrative shortcut or narrative flattening emerged as part of what we might call like an intellectual backlash to Me Too, right? But here, it's being deployed for a male character in the Fennell script, right? She's like, look, this male character who is violent and filled with rage and hatred and contempt, he is formed by past experiences of violence, right? Whereas Wuthering Heights, her source material, the Emily Bronte book, is a book with shocking amounts of violence against women, gendered violence. It's got domestic violence. Yeah. It has beating. It has rape. It has women basically as commodities, right? It has pregnancy that is unwilled and forced. It has, you know, maternal mortality, right? It's a book about the things that men and the things that gender do to women and the ways it can constrain their lives. And Emerald Fennell takes basically all of that out.
Yeah.
And I think really you want to drill down on Heathcliff's relationship with Isabella Linton, right? Which in the Bronte material is brutally abusive.
Yeah.
Like, it shocks the conscience to read this. That's part of why you can't retrospectively read the first act of Wuthering Heights as this like bodice-ripping aspirational romance, because this guy rapes and beats the shit out of this woman for a big chunk of the book.
Yeah.
Fennell transforms that into a consensual BDSM relationship. And that is where I think you transition from like, this is a bad movie to like, this is kind of an evil movie, or like, this is an anti-feminist movie, right? Because the notion that this is like a problem for partisans of BDSM in general, that what they consider sexy looks so much like just like actual gender abuse. But that is sort of like taken on as a reading and a presentation of this relationship in a way that I find like really irresponsible and frankly evocative of like other anti-feminist intellectual moves, right? Like, what was Sigmund Freud doing when he rejected the seduction theory, except like taking an account of sexual violence and turning it into an account of sexual fantasy? Like, what was, like, you know, like the sex radicals did this to the anti-violence feminists when they like posited a critique of porn or of BDSM. They were like, actually, you just got off on this. You know, like Sophie Lewis did that to Andrea Dworkin. Like, this is like a recurring theme when women try to advance a political critique of rape to like be accused of sort of desiring rape or of desiring sexual violence. And I think like Emerald Fennell is sort of playing into that with what she did with the Isabella character. And that's why I left like actually mad. I was like, no. He fucking rapes and beats this woman. And she's not like happy about it or winking about it as she literally does in the movie. It also was very conspicuous to me that Fennell went out of her way to clarify for viewers that Heathcliff does not kill the dog.
Yeah.
She like in the book, he very much does kill the dog. And in the movie, you get a shot of the dog very much alive after they have departed. And she did that on purpose because she knew that her viewers, she was more afraid of what it would evoke in her viewers if she said that he killed the dog than what it would evoke in her viewers if she eroticized rape. And like, that is very telling to me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking now about this movie holistically and about the fact that like, what's the point of not just telling a story like this in 2026, but rather to adapt a novel like Wuthering Heights?
Mm-hmm.
And if the project is to return some of the earthiness to this. And I mean, that's very clearly aesthetically what she's going for. What is then the point of the move that you're describing? Of saying, oh, but this part of the novel is now just fully a fantasy, right? That's not real. Everything else is squeaky, icky, real. Get used to it, man. And this part, it's just fantasy. Like, okay, there's a way you can tell the story where everything is kind of fantastical, given that like it's all told by, again, like we know what happens in the book through Nelly. You could imagine a version where Nelly is someone with an overactive imagination, but then that applies to everything globally. But what's noticeable here is that Fennell actually leans into two contradictory impulses for different subplots, even though they're happening in the same fucking universe. And it's like, well, okay, then that seems to be about extra aesthetic considerations and preferences. You'd rather not deal with this, which I get, having read this three times now, and like, it's like, I wouldn't want to have to put that shit on screen, right? But it's not bold if you then pull your punches in the most telling place, where, as you say, where it would put this movie in a totally different category and have it be part of a very different conversation. I mean, really, it would be quite a difficult movie to promote, and it seems like Fennell doesn't want to promote it, you know?
Yeah, it's a lost opportunity. I feel like, you know, if you want to be gross, be gross. Like, if you want to be a true freak, be a true freak. Don't pull your punches. Put the necrophilia and the rape and the wife beating on the scene. Don't have Heathcliff ask for consent. It's not what he would do.
Anyway, so that's our long reaction to the book of the moment.
I think we talked for about as long as the movie is.
Yeah, yeah.
You should, I mean, it's, I just called for a rape apologist, but go see it. It's hot trash. It's fun. It's very, like, fun to look at. You know, you'll have a good time.
Yeah, yeah.
So long as you turn your brain off entirely.
Yeah. Just sit on some eggs.
Stick your finger in some aspic. It'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah. And get the closest pig and just, like, let it all out. Like that pig. Anyway, thank you for listening as always and following us down yet another one of our weird rabbit holes, and see you next time on In Bed With The Right.
Thanks for listening.
In Bed With The Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.